into these programs are for homeless like sustenance programs. They're not transitioning into permanent housing. Right. And Misty and Talani and Dominique are all examples of 211 and all of these different programs not working. Wages have not kept pace with inflation. People are invested in a system that is broken. And so it's incumbent upon our legislators to listen to the moms, to listen to people who've been a part of these programs that are just broken, so that we can do something different. If we do not address the entirety of the problem, then it will only persist. We have to address that the fact that income inequality is growing, but rents keep going up. The price of homes keeps rising. So if we're not addressing the entire issue, then we're just putting Band-Aids on bullet wounds, and it has to stop.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us, Carol Fife, director of the Oakland Office for Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, and Misty Cross of Moms for Housing. You can see all our coverage of this issue at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Cable Community Radio holds open meeting concerning the operations and programming of Cable in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about Cable Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, unless otherwise noted. The KVU Board of Directors will meet Tuesday, January 28th at 6 p.m. instead of Monday for their January board meeting.
KVU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2020 Portland Mochitsky Festival on Sunday, January 26th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Viking Pavilion in Portland. The Mochitsky Festival celebrates the New Year by sharing Japanese-American culture with the community. The festival features hands-on activities for all ages, cultural foods, vendors, and a wide variety of demonstrations and performances, including taiko drumming, Japanese dance, storytelling, mochi pounding, martial art demos, and much more. Again, that's the 2020 Portland Mochitsky Festival on Sunday, January 26th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Viking Pavilion, 930 Southwest Hall Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. It's 8:02. Time for Sojourner Truth Radio.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. As the death toll continues to rise in fires that have burned in huge swaths of Australia, we have the sad news that three U.S. firefighters were killed in Australia when their aerial water tanker crashed while battling fires in mountainous terrain. That brings the death toll to 30. And over a billion animals have been burned. What can be done? And controversy has broken out between the Women's March Foundation Los Angeles and Black Lives Matter, and we get an update and analysis on the impeachment hearings against Donald Trump now taking place in Washington, D.C. Our guests are Cam Walker, the campaign's coordinator for Friends of the Earth in Australia, and he's also a volunteer firefighter with the Country Fire Authority. Dr. Malina Abdullah, who is with Black Lives Matter Los Angeles. She's also a professor, author, community campaigner. and Gina Belafonte. She is the executive director of Sankofa.org, a social justice organization that enlists the support of today's artists and influential individuals in collaboration with grassroots partners. She is also part of Women's March Los Angeles. And Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, where she taught for 25 years. She's also the former president of the National Lawyers Guild and criminal defense attorney. She's a legal scholar and political analyst. So those are our guests today. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We're starting off today with our weekly Earth Watch. We're bringing you part one of a conversation with Cam Walker, an Australian environmentalist and volunteer firefighter. I spoke with Cam yesterday, and today we learned the sad news of three U.S. firefighters who were killed in Australia when their aerial water tanker crashed while battling fires in mountainous terrain. The total deaths thus far in the fires, which began in September of 2019, is now 30. Thousands of structures have been burned. The number of firefighters killed now stands at 8. There are still 70 fires burning in Australia, according to the Washington Post. 44 of them are out of control. The airport in Canberra, Australia's capital city, has been closed, and people in major cities, including Sydney and Melbourne, are struggling to breathe. The amount of smoke produced by the fires, according to NASA, is enough to circle the globe. And experts are telling us that pollutants from the fire are being spread worldwide. Sadly, over a billion animals have been killed. But interestingly enough, the fires have not impacted areas of Australia under the control of Indigenous people. Indigenous people in Australia won control back to some of their land. Indigenous people are referred by some as Aboriginal people. And the fires have not impacted those areas under Indigenous government and control due to their connectedness with the land and the traditional practices they have used of controlling fires for thousands of years. Let us go now to part one of a conversation with Cam Walker. Before we welcome our guests, let us go to a clip that's actually should be scary to all of us. It's from The Guardian. And it is saying that it could take a century to recover in Australia.
It's been catastrophic, in a word. Catastrophic because of the profound effect of the fire on killing so many individual animals. In terms of the numbers of individuals, the number of species that are potentially lost, and the potential damage long-term to ecosystems, this season has been really unprecedented in terms of what we've seen before. One of the big things about the kangaroos and koalas and wombats is that they're pretty shy animals. They don't normally go near people. So to find kangaroos in numbers sheltering on people's front lawns is really quite incredible. And for them to come in and congregate in the presence of humans means that they're overcoming a terror to overcome what would usually be common fear. There's no doubt that the figure is over a billion animals that would have been caught up and killed in the fires. It's quite likely that many of these slower-moving animals would have been killed immediately. So that will include the koala, of course. We've seen horrible images of burnt koalas, burnt kangaroos, wombats, and so on. But some animals would survive. They would go underground. They might be in tree hollows that were in less intensely burned areas of forest. But when they emerge, they find there are no resources, no food, no water, no shelter, no habitat, the likelihood would be that many, or indeed most of those, would die at some later time. It may well be 100 years before some forest components that are really essential for a wide range of animal species, decades or 100 years before they come back. This has shaken Australia, certainly, out of the lethargy that it had about its effect on the environment. We've really sleepwalked into this disaster. I think there is a sentiment at the moment that we have ignored the environment to a large degree, and it's now come back to bite us. And that's the case. We really need to think seriously about how we can mend our ways and look after the environment much better in the future.
All righty, just something of concern, not only for people living in Australia, but for those of us in the United States and indeed around the world. I'd like to welcome our guest. Cam Walker is the campaign's coordinator for Friends of the Earth in Australia, working across its campaigns from climate and energy justice to forests to inland rivers. He's also a volunteer firefighter with the County Fire Authority. Cam lives in central Victoria, about 100 miles north of Melbourne. And Cam Walker, welcome, and thank you for getting up at this hour to speak with us.
Thanks, Margaret. You're welcome.
Yeah, and for us, actually, I'm talking to Cam on Wednesday, January 22nd. But for you, Cam, is it Thursday morning? Is that it, the 23rd?
Yes, it is. It is early Thursday morning.
Yeah, and really thank you also for your efforts, not only on behalf of the environment, but also being a volunteer firefighter. And Cam, have you, the area where you are based, has that been impacted by the fires? And if so, how?
We have been fairly lucky this year, although I was out at a fire last night that had started as a result of lightning. But our part of the state has been okay. It has been the eastern part, an area called East Gippsland, which has been absolutely devastated this summer.
Right, okay. Now, we know that there's your Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, a climate change denier. And increasingly, we're getting reports that people are growing impatient in Australia because people are increasingly making the connection with these fires and with climate change. I'd like you to comment on that. But also the estimate, the roundup that we did at the beginning about how many people have been killed, the buildings burned, the acreage, et cetera. Is that right? Or are there any updates you'd like to add to it, or any corrections you'd like to make?
I think those figures were generally correct, although it does keep growing. My understanding is we've now hit 18 million hectares of land which has been burnt, and my understanding is the equivalent view would be 46 million acres.
Wow.
So an absolutely astounding level of land. And as you said in the intro, particularly in the East Coast, so from Queensland through New South Wales and the Australian Capital Territory into Victoria, there's been substantial fires in Western Australia and South Australia now. So a huge part of the continent has been impacted, and certainly the larger cities. So Sydney has had terrible smoke pollution, as has the national capital, Canberra, for weeks on end. And there's some really serious concerns around the long-term public health implications of that. You know, sometimes schools are closed, you know, people, elderly people and people that are pregnant are asked to stay indoors, you know, sporting events being cancelled. It's actually hard to convey the level of impact this has had on the day-to-day life of Australia. It's not just something happening in a remote corner. It has been Melbourne, Sydney, Canberra, and we're in the middle of summer, of course, and literally millions of people leave the cities in summer. You know, we have the great Australian tradition of going down the coast, and people have been evacuated in their thousands, in some instances by the Australian Navy, where towns have been cut off by the fire. So you know, unprecedented is a word we love to use, I guess, but it really has been, the scale of this has been unprecedented.
Yeah, I saw a story a while back of people who were literally trapped on the beaches. They had run from where they were and had to be rescued by boats. Just a horrific situation. And the Washington Post had an article on January 21st by someone who lives in Melbourne, actually, and described, you know, how just breathing hurts. And it was really a good description of, you know, what you go through day to day, you know, even having children and as a mother, and the impact it has had on her family. But also she talked about the small particles that are not visible to the naked eye that can get trapped in your lungs. And I also read that not only in terms of the pollution will it impact those of you, of course, in the impacted areas, but people like yourself, not necessarily in the impacted areas, but also to others of us in other parts of the world. What can you tell us about that, the impact of the pollution before we even get to the animals, et cetera, but just breathing in Australia?
Yes, the breathing has been hard. No one as yet has had the ability to look into the public health implications of this, but we do know that respiratory illness and asthma, you know, all of those things are trending up very radically, and that, of course, has impact on our health system. People are obviously having to go to hospital and see doctors. That's going to have a large economic cost. The economic cost of this is actually already in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and will go into the billions of dollars, and that's entire regions that are reliant on, you know, summertime tourism. You know, they haven't had a summer, they haven't had any trade. Food is already becoming more expensive because also some of the areas that are being hit, and it's a mixture of forested land, national parks and state forests, but also private land, including farms. You know, farm prices are going up, and that has implications for low-income people that have less available income. So, you know, the impacts of this will play out. As a firefighter, you know, we wear masks when we fight fires, but there are going to be health impacts associated with that. You're getting houses, particularly older houses, burning that will have materials like asbestos in them. There's a whole range of public health impacts that we haven't even had a chance to consider as yet. And then what's happened is we've started to get rain, and these areas have been absolutely devastated. And now, you know, what should be a river has turned into basically, you know, a mud pile, and we're getting mass fish kills and enormous erosion and landslides. So the environmental impacts will just keep kind of rolling on, because we've lost all the vegetation cover that keeps the hills together. So, the scale of this, it's kind of like the train wreck that just, you know, you think it's over and it just kind of keeps on going into another form.
Yeah, and of course, we're based, this show, we do our show out of Southern California, and then we're rebroadcast, you know, in a number of other places in the United States. But you likely know of the fires we have had here in Southern California and across California. And I could tell you, nowhere as devastating or as massive as in Australia, but we had such trouble breathing here. And those of us with respiratory issues, people like myself and so many people, particularly low-income people, Black people, people of color, Indigenous people, getting asthma as an adult when you didn't have it, you know, as a child. And it just feels practically every day. I actually, when I look at the weather, I look to see, you know, whether it's going to be a good air day or if it's going to be one of those days where they're saying, well, people with respiratory illnesses should stay in. And what struck me by that article in Australia, I mean, she really asks, is this going to be the new normal for us? And you have been working in the areas of protecting the environment for quite some time now. And I imagine you have been up against quite a bit, having a prime minister denying climate change, as we here in the United States, we have somebody in the White House who has denied climate change as well. So tell us, for somebody like yourself doing this work with Friends of the Earth, what have been some of the challenges you have met doing this work on the environment?
So Australia makes a large proportion of its foreign income through exporting a whole range of minerals, including coal. And the fact that we make so much money off coal royalties impacts on every aspect of our economy. And it means that there are very close links between the fossil fuel sector and the federal Australian government and many of the state governments. And that's simply because our Conservative Party, so our, if you like, our equivalent of the Republicans, are called the Liberal Party, and they're in a coalition with the Rural Party called the Nationals. So the Liberal National Party tends to be dominated by people who are very politically conservative. It's very much the situation in the United States that, you know, played out in the Southern Hemisphere. They're climate deniers. There's a growing dominance of right-wing Christianity. So, for instance, our Prime Minister is a Pentecostalist, which is actually a very small minority group in the country, but he's brought that kind of form of evangelical Christianity into the fore. And, yes, the Liberal National Party is just dominated by climate deniers and people who think there's no link between digging up coal and climate change. And that's been the dominant narrative, and we've played a terrible role in the international climate negotiations. We continue to export vast volumes of coal. I believe now the world's largest liquid natural gas exporter. So our economy is based to a very large degree on the export of fossil fuels, and that kind of leads to this unwillingness by the government to accept the links with climate change, and so this denial, and it's very pervasive throughout society.
Yeah, and there was an article where the coal industry, an Australian coal company, is saying that the bushfire smoke, this was in the New York Times, is slowing down production, at which point several people just roll their eyes. But it does say that the article, the New York Times, says Australia is the world's largest exporter of coal, and that the industry has the kind of influence that you just pointed out, and that the coal exports are worth $67 billion Australian dollars. That's about $45 billion U.S. dollars, and exporting to China, Japan, you know, India, etc. So the sixth biggest producer of fuels that release carbon, that is Australia. And also, I wanted to ask about Indigenous communities and the Indigenous practices that are now increasingly being looked at. But I also wondered, you know, we had seen massive protests. We saw some of them by young people in Australia. That growing worldwide movement of children, really, saying that their future is being threatened. And have any of these protests happened since the fires have broken out? I mean, how are people responding in that way?
I think that more and more people are joining the dots between fossil fuels and climate change and bushfires. And I am hopeful that this will be a summer where we have a watershed moment where the conversation will change nationally. Our Prime Minister has handled the whole affair very badly and is really struggling in the polls now. When the fires really started before Christmas, he was off on family holidays in Hawaii and he was seen to be missing in action, and that was a really bad look. And, you know, I think his level of empathy hasn't been really well received from people. There's any number of social media, you know, videos circulating of him going into affected communities and people refusing to shake his hand and firefighters yelling at him and telling him to leave. I think it hasn't been his finest moment, and that is good in that it creates space for other narratives, because he's not able to shape the narrative because so many people feel that he has failed us. There's been massive protests around the country against his inaction on climate change, and some of that has been driven by the student strikers, who originally were influenced by Greta Thunberg. Extinction Rebellion has grown very rapidly here. But there's been grassroots, like there's already been a national day of action where thousands and thousands of people in hundreds of locations have come out to demand action on fire. So it does feel like we're at a point where, you know, things could change. There was some polling released yesterday that showed that concerns for the environment was actually topping all other concerns, including concern for the economy. And I think that people really are realizing that if we continue down the path we're on, which is, you know, heading towards 2 or 3 or 6 degrees Celsius warming, this is just the taste of what's going to come. You know, this is what's happened with just over 1 degree Celsius of warming. Imagine if we get to 2. So I feel that people are starting to kind of, you know, mobilize around that, and the light bulb is going on over people's heads. And I feel that the government is being pushed to at least say, yes, we accept there's a link between fossil fuels, climate change and fire, and they keep being pushed, and they're being pushed by public sentiment, and I'm really heartened by that.
Yes, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for part one. You'll need to tune in to get part two of the conversation with Cam Walker, where we go into the traditional indigenous practices and how they have helped on indigenous land to hold off forest, these kinds of bushfires. And also that is now increasingly being looked at by the mainstream in Australia. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We want to thank Aaron Langell and the Global Justice Ecology Project overall. We partner with them for our weekly Earth Watch and our weekly Earth Minute. We're going to take our station break now, and when we return, controversy has broken out between the Women's March Foundation Los Angeles and Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter saying that they were excluded from the most recent Women's March in Los Angeles. And waiting to speak with us about all of this is Dr. Melina Abdullah, who is a founder of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, as well as Gina Belafonte, who is with Sankofa.org, and she is also part of Women's March Los Angeles. And Marjorie Cohn will be joining us with some analysis on the impeachment trial now underway. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Islam was never given.
Good morning, this is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, One Land, Many Voices. Host Leila Kanaan explores political, social, and cultural issues affecting Palestine, Israel. Then at 10, Voices for the Animals, a program that tackles issues around animals' rights with interviews of frontline activists who are working to make a difference in the lives of animals around the world. At 10:30, Film at 11, a panel broadcast reviewing the latest films and shows from the multiplex to the art house and beyond, followed by Rising Up with Sonali at 11. Portland area weather, rain and showers for the rest of the week.
That group, First Nations Aboriginal group in Australia, that's Treaty Now by Yothu Yindi. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. You're a member of Facebook. You can like and friend us on Facebook. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott, and our handle on Instagram and Twitter at So True Radio. Check out our website also at www.sotrueradio.org. There you can see video and photos and other articles that we're not able to cover during our hour. And we're also across the nation and worldwide on SoundCloud. And in our tradition, I'd like to give a shout out in the United States to our SoundCloud listeners in Carbondale in Southern Illinois. We hope to return to Southern Illinois and to tell you about some of the anti-war and peace activities going on there. We hope to do that next week. A shout out to Carbondale, all of our listeners and friends in Southern Illinois. Internationally, I'd like to give a shout out to our listeners in Australia as we think of them and we lift them up in this time of crisis with the fires. We're now going to turn our attention to the controversy that broke out between the Women's March Foundation Los Angeles and Black Lives Matter Black Lives Matter Los Angeles. And just to share with you, quote an article that appeared in the LA Progressive. It says, Black Lives Matter Los Angeles has been excluded from the fourth annual Women's March in Los Angeles. Women's March LA did not invite Black Lives Matter to participate. They failed to respond to an email request for inclusion and further refused speaking time during a subsequent conversation. Now, Black Lives Matter had participated in previous women's marches. Now, I did reach out to the executive director of Women's March LA, a Latina woman, Emiliana Guerica, and she right now is ill, actually, but also said that she didn't want to come on the air to discuss this until after she sat down and others from Women's March LA sat down with representatives from Black Lives Matter LA. But she did issue this statement. She said, quote, "I'm not going to let people pit black and brown communities against each other. Black Lives Matter LA has and is always invited to Women's March LA. Not speaking on our program doesn't mean we don't work together or stand with BLM, Black Lives Matter. Women's March LA is led by women of color." So let's unpack what's going on, what are the tensions, what can be done about it. I would like to welcome Dr. Melina Abdullah. And for full transparency, we here at Sojourner Truth, we do partner with Black Lives Matter LA for our weekly Campaigners for Black Lives, which you heard on our airwaves on Wednesdays. Dr. Melina Abdullah, professor, author, community organizer in Los Angeles. She is a founder of Black Lives Matter LA. Melina, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Sister Margaret.
Okay, sounds like you're getting whatever is going around yourself. You got to take care there. There's something bad going around. Yeah. And I'd also like to welcome Gina Belafonte, Executive Director of Sankofa.org, a social justice organization that enlists the support of today's artists and influential individuals in collaboration with grassroots partners to elevate the voices of the disenfranchised and promote peace, justice, and equality. Gina Belafonte works with diverse artists, activists, and organizations around the nation and worldwide to promote cultural and civic engagement. And last week, prior to the Women's March, our listeners heard both from Emiliana, known as Emmy, and Gina in the lead up to the Women's March. Gina, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
Okay, so let's dig into this. Melina Abdullah, tell us what happened. What is the situation? What is your complaint against Women's March LA?
Sure. And we'd also like to uplift that Gina and I do work together outside of Women's March. So we have a very cordial, friendly relationship. We're friends. So this is not an adversarial conversation at all. So what happened is Black Lives Matter every year has been invited to speak at the Women's March. We've spoken for the last 3 years. And this fourth year, we did not get an invitation. And so people within Black Lives Matter Los Angeles started asking, are we speaking at the Women's March? So I sent an email to Emiliana and never got a response. And so as the time got closer, my daughter, who's been on the stage with me, you know Tandiwe, and she took on a pretty significant role last year and the year before, asked, are we speaking at the Women's March? Because she was kind of planning her time. And so it became clear that we didn't get an email back, so we posted on Twitter that we have not been invited to speak at the Women's March. And so Gina, I guess the tweet was brought to Gina's attention, and Gina immediately texts me and says, can we have a conversation? And of course we can have a conversation. So Gina and I had a good conversation, and then she asked if I'd be willing to talk with Emiliana. And so she kind of facilitated a conversation between Emiliana and me.
So it was just Emiliana and you, and not the three of you, not you, Gina, and Emiliana?
No, it was all three of us, but Gina was kind of the facilitator of the conversation.
Right.
And so Emiliana and Gina, in our one-on-one conversation, said that she didn't have, you know, didn't have access to the lineup. She wasn't sure who was speaking. And, you know, the initial response that I got from Gina is they were trying to give space to new voices. And I asked, well, who is it? Who else is speaking? What other Black grassroots women leaders are speaking? And so she didn't know. And so she put us, the three of us, on a call. And Emiliana, on that call, even though I requested to speak, Emiliana said that, you know, they were giving space for new voices, and then used the, I'll say it's an excuse, that they were focusing on electoral politics, and that was not the focus of Black Lives Matter, which I refuted because, you know, we're part of the coalition behind Measure R. We're we've been trying to advocate for the ousting of Jackie Lacey for the last 2.5 years, and we've been doing, we're part of a national coalition called Electoral Justice Under the Movement for Black Lives. So there's a lot of electoral work that we do, even though that's not our sole work or even our primary work. And so that's kind of what unfolded. And then in conversation with other Black Lives Matter chapters who were also excluded from their local marches, so Black Lives Matter D.C., Black Lives Matter Houston, and I think there was one more city, all confirmed that they'd spoken for the last 3 years and were excluded from the stage in their cities. And so D.C. had put out their own statement, and we thought it was important to document what happened in Los Angeles. So we were able to quickly write something and have it published in the L.A. Progressive.
Right. And just to clarify, because I had heard two things. I had heard that Black Lives Matter L.A. was not calling for a boycott of Women's March L.A. And then I think I got a text or something the day of saying that Black Lives Matter LA was indeed calling for an informal boycott. So what's the difference, Melina, between an informal boycott and a boycott?
So we did not call for a boycott.
Okay,
that was
not so I was mis-
Black Lives Matter calls. But let me add this, that many of the organizations and individuals who align with Black Lives Matter boycotted on their own, and we really appreciate the show of solidarity. So that is, you know, we're thankful that organizations and individuals chose to do that.
Right. So, Gina Belafonte, clearly you have been trying to facilitate the conversation here, and just from your perspective, I mean, you were on the stage. You were, I actually wasn't there. I was with Reverend Barber from the Poor People's Campaign in Fontana that weekend, from Friday and all Saturday until Saturday evening. So what's going on here, Gina, from your perspective? I know you're speaking for Sankofa.org right now.
Yes, I'm not a representative of the Women's March. I have so much to say about just the ongoing lack of strategy in many movements that come together. And I feel sometimes that there's a lot of hurt feelings and miscommunication that happens if you don't get the principles together, which was what my desire was, to get Emiliana and Melina so that I could hear their voices and hear their perspectives, because a lot of people don't suspend their first judgment. They jump quickly to judgment. And, you know, until we get to a deeper truth and understanding with each other, then we can't ask other people to transform themselves in this world and get to a deeper truth about who they are and how we can transform all of our lives. With that said, my participation in the Women's March, which has been since its inception, I was originally asked to participate because there was a lack of diversity. This was way back in the very beginning, 4 years ago. And so I came on board specifically to insert my community of Black, Latino, Indigenous people, or at least my strategy around the inclusion of communities of color in the very first march. The way the leadership of these things sometimes come together is also not a very strategic movement positioned, if that makes sense. So Emiliana Guareca and Dina Katz, who became the heads of Women's March Los Angeles, really was because they were sort of first to the line. Emiliana, when she found out that there was going to be a Women's March, she was the person who was in production who immediately got all of the, or when a Women's March was first asked for, she got all the permits because she is in production. And then because of the way it was unfolding on Facebook, Dina Katz reached out to her as a event. She is the person who does the talent coordination for Dancing with the Stars and the Bill Maher Show. And so when these two women came together who never knew each other before, they took on the leadership role of the Women's March in Los Angeles.
Okay.
So from the very beginning, there was issue around inclusion and diversity, and that's why I was asked to participate. So then I functioned each year coordinating with program and making sure there was representation, and constantly, especially on the rally stage at the end of the march where there's a rally, having issue with the way in which that programming has been coordinated, which has been predominantly in the hands of Dina Katz. So anyway, long story longer, I did not have anything to do with the programming this year. I have been doing other work and collaborating with other collaborators. And so, of course, if I had known early on, I would have inquired, I would have asked, perhaps there would have been an opportunity for Emmy to have gone deeper into seeing that there was an email that was sent to her, which for some reason she didn't see. I don't know if it got lost in her inbox, whatever the issue is.
Right. Well,
one of the things I do know about the march is that it is a free speech or right to gather permit. So anyone can come and participate. And I think that, you know, because there were over 30 organizations that were not asked to participate this year that have participated in previous years.
You mean participated on the stage for speaking?
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so there were over 30 organizations that were also not included and also gave a lot of feelings about not being included, that Emmy took the brunt of handling all of that, or not the brunt, but she took the calls to hear from those people. So but there's a deeper accountability issue, I think, that needs to come forward, that where, you know, especially as it relates to specifically to Black Lives Matter Los Angeles and Tembiwe, Melina's daughter. There was an accusation made by other organizations that there was an issue. And, you know, last year, Emiliana chose to stand in solidarity and support Tembiwe. Mm-hmm. But there was also a request made in that fact. And that request has not been followed through. And so there are things that need to be healed, that need to be accounted for. And we need to really do this work. I mean, this is the work that we need to do with each other. And I can find issue in a lot of other movements, including the Poor People's Campaign and other things, where there's issue with leadership. And but you don't want to dismantle the work, but you do want to heal within, because if we continue to ask people in the world to transform themselves and create a better place in society, then we need to do that work. And I will also say my last point, which is that Black women are the most marginalized women on the planet, Indigenous and Black women, Native and Black women. And I will also say that if you're going to have a women's march or a women's movement, Black women and Indigenous women need to be centered in that movement, and you need to start there.
Yeah, Gina, I do want Melina to come back to Melina, and Marjorie Cohn is waiting to speak with us also about the, you know, what's happening in this zoo going on in D.C. with the impeachment. But points well made. And Melina, just back to you, Amina, a question, you know, that I've heard is that, were you all making the case of exclusion of Black Lives Matter specifically, or of grassroots, Black grassroots activists? I mean, I'm one of those people who spoke last year, got criticized because I talked about the Palestinian women living under apartheid, right? I wasn't invited this year to speak, and you know, frankly, had other things to do. But was it specific to Black Lives Matter, or were you being more inclusive about others of us that weren't included? Because there's some feelings kind of around that too, because some people feel that some organizations put themselves forward or fight for their voices and not for the voices of others who perhaps are in similar situations. Melina.
Right. So the first question was around Black women grassroots leaders generally. So when Gina said space for new voices, we said, okay, well, what Black women grassroots leaders have been invited to speak? And it turns out there weren't, if you look at the lineup, there were Black women, but they were all women with high profiles, Maxine Waters and Karen Bass and entertainers. It had been expressed by Emiliana that Janet Robinson Flint from Black Women for Wellness had been invited, but she had not been invited.
Wow.
And so the exclusion of Black women grassroots leaders was a big issue. But then it's also Black Lives Matter specifically, because if you go to the Women's March LA's website, it named Black Lives Matter is actually the only current organization that's named as one of its inspirations.
Okay.
So if we're one of your inspirations, then we need to be on the stage every year. And then finally, just addressing Gina's point about Tandiwe, I just want to clarify, Tandiwe was accused, that's my child who had just turned 14 at the time, was accused of making horrific, violent, threatening anti-Semitic comments, which of course she did not make at all, and we were promised a letter of apology, but we never got that. And that has real, not just traumatic experience, it's not just a traumatic experience for Tandiwe, but as a Black Muslim girl activist in a time when they're targeted in schools and there's a Black identity extremist report going around, it has very real ramifications. So we're looking to Women's March to make that right.
Right. Well, we'll continue to follow this story. We actually have the clip of Tandiwe's speech, but we're out of time. We're just not able to do it. We will play it at another time. And clearly in that speech, she did not make any such comments that she was accused of. So Gina Belafonte and Melina Abdullah, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
All righty. Okay, we're going to wrap our show up. We want to thank Marjorie Cohn being patient here with us. This has been an explosive issue, Marjorie, going on in Los Angeles in particular. Marjorie Cohn, Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, where she taught for 25 years, former president of the National Lawyers Guild and criminal defense attorney, legal scholar, political analyst, author of books and articles, and an expert. So Marjorie Cohn, we're happy to have you, and we will just allow you, we won't play clips, we've cut that, to just go for it, to give your analysis on what has happened thus far in the impeachment hearings. Welcome, Marjorie Cohn.
Thank you, Margaret. Well, the House managers, the prosecutors, spent the first day yesterday laying out a meticulous case proving that Trump did the things that are alleged in the articles of impeachment, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. And the Republican senators, many of them had never heard that before. They didn't hear it when the House was doing its inquiry. A lot of it was going over ground that had been covered before, but they didn't hear it because they tuned it out, watched Fox News. But in this Senate trial, all 100 senators are forced to sit silently in their seats with no cell phones and presumably, unless they're really good at dissembling, pay attention. Now, the first day was taken up with pretrial motions, and of course, in the House inquiry, many witnesses were subpoenaed, and in an unprecedented move, Trump, like no impeached president before him or president facing impeachment, refused to turn over even one document and said, well, I am not going to let any executive branch witnesses testify. They have absolute immunity from civil and criminal prosecution. Now, 17 witnesses still did testify. They defied his order, and they laid out a very strong case. 9 witnesses didn't, and some of them are very important witnesses that the House managers are now trying to convince the Senate to subpoena. But what happened was, not only did the Senate, along strict party lines, the Republican-controlled Senate, table the motions to call these witnesses, including John Bolton and Mick Mulvaney, and to produce documents, but it's not clear they're ever going to get to it. One of the things that the Trump's defense talked about the first day was, the threat to executive privilege if these witnesses are forced to testify and how that's going to impact presidents in the future. Actually, Trump never asserted executive privilege. He asserted this cockamamie theory of absolute immunity, which no court has ever upheld. And executive privilege is something that it's basically some internal executive branch communications are protected against being disclosed, but that does not mean that the witnesses can't testify. They get up and testify, and then the administration would say, no, we assert executive privilege, and then the judge, in this case Roberts, or really the senators, would say, yes, he can answer, no, he can't. And one of the really interesting things is that Trump is very, very concerned about John Bolton testifying. John Bolton's the former national security advisor, and Trump, who's been following all of this and tweeting, unprecedented numbers of tweets, is really worried. He says that Bolton should not be allowed to testify because he knows my thoughts on certain people and other governments, war and peace and different things. That's a national security problem. And then Trump said, I don't know if we left on the best of terms. You don't like people testifying when they didn't leave on good terms. And that was due to him, to me. That was due to me, not him.
Right. Yeah, well... Yeah, well, Marjorie Cohn, I also want to point people to an article that was published in Truthout that's really excellent. If you really want to break down to find out what is going on, it's called First the Trial, Then the Evidence, Impeachment in Wonderland. Interesting title there, written by Marjorie Cohn. But it does seem as though what is happening, and I wondered quickly if you could say what you think about this format, because Adam Schiff, and clearly what the Democrats are trying to do, is to speak to a few Republicans that they're still hoping will support them on the question of witnesses, for example, but also to the general public, right? And how do you think this is going over to the general public? I mean, it's very detailed. It's very precise. Clearly, the Democrats are laying out a very careful and precise case. But even the senators, it's now being reported, don't seem to be paying attention. You know, they're getting up, they're walking around, they're falling asleep, they're getting bored. You know, what do you think about this strategy, Marjorie Cohn?
Well, the strategy actually was laid down by Mitch McConnell, who originally wanted each side, the managers on one side and Trump's defense on the other, to spend 24 hours over 2 days presenting their case, which would be 12-hour days. Now, after some negotiation, they said, well, they agreed to 3 days. So it's 8-hour days instead of 12-hour days, and they have to sit there. As I said, they've probably never been away from their cell phone for that long. But a Pew Research poll showed that 51% of respondents think that Trump should be removed. 70% think he probably or definitely acted unethically, and 63% say he probably broke the law. Now,
wow.
One of the really interesting things, Margaret, is that here he is watching this, And he says, and this is, I think could be the biggest takeaway from the entire day yesterday. He says, this is Trump, quote, "I got to watch enough. I thought our team did a very good job. But honestly, we have all the material. They don't have the material," unquote. And so what
implicating himself.
He is admitting to guilt of Article 2, obstruction of Congress. That's exactly what the House managers are trying to do, is to get documents from the White House, the Office of Management and Budget, the Defense Department, and one other agency. And Trump is saying, we've got them and you don't. In other words, he could actually, and this was one of the motions, the House manager motions that was denied, they are concerned that he can cherry-pick. He can cherry-pick the documents he has and introduce the ones that support him without the managers being allowed to round it out and produce the rest of the documents in context. This is a very well-established rule of completeness in the law, where if one part of a statement or a document is produced, the rest of it has to be produced as well. And so here's Trump actually admitting to obstruction of Congress. Now, whether or not it will resonate with the senators, I don't think it will. In terms of the ultimate result, they are walking in lockstep. Like, I think that Frank Rich said it best when he coined the phrase Vichy Republicans. And this is something that I put in my article. Of course, yeah. The Vichy government was the French government during the Nazi occupation of France that did Hitler's bidding.
That's right.
Vichy Republicans is exactly what they are, Margaret.
Well, Marjorie Cohn, we know that you are in great demand but to talk about this. We hope to be able to get a bit more of your time, because there's a lot more I wanted to dig in with you. And we'll need to do that, and hope that you'll be able to find some time to join us again. We appreciate your work. And again, article in Truth Out by Marjorie Cohn. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Margaret.
Okay, we're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. Our assistant producer is Romero Funes, and our engineer today, Ricky Herrera. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center in Portland. Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra combine Celtic music, interactive lights, Irish dancing, and fun. Pre-show attendees are invited to participate in the Magical Music Petting Zoo, where they can touch and play instruments that inspire the creative mind. Again, that's the Katie Jane and Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center, 3350 Southeast Francis Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Chinatown's 5th Annual Lunar New Year Dragon Dance Parade on Saturday, January 25th from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The New Year Dragon Dance Parade to celebrate the Year of the Rat begins at Northwest 3rd and Davis at 11:30 a.m. and ends at the Oregon Historical Society. Live afternoon performances and activities will begin at 1:30 p.m. Again, that's Portland Chinatown's 5th Annual Lunar New Year Dragon Dance Parade on Saturday, January 25th from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The parade begins at Northwest 3rd and Davis at 11:30 a.m. and the activities and performances begin at 1:30 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. Information about the parade route, performers, and sponsors can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.